It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Peter Heinlein reporting. Saudi King to skip White House summit. Saudi Arabia's King Salman telephoned President Barack Obama Monday to say he is sorry he will not be attending this week's U.S. Gulf Cooperation Council summit near Washington. The White House says the two leaders talked about the agenda for the meeting that will focus on better ways the U.S. and its Gulf allies can cooperate on such regional crises as the fighting in Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Yemen. The White House is dismissing speculation the Saudi king's absence is a snub and will put a damper on talks. VOA's Aru Pandey reports.
The Saudi king's absence at the upcoming summit dominated Monday's White House briefing, where Press Secretary Josh Earnest told reporters it was not related to any Saudi concerns about the agenda at Camp David.
The feedback that we've received from the Saudis has been positive.
Of the six participating nations, only the emirs of Kuwait and Qatar will be present. Bahrain, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Oman will be sending senior officials and not heads of state. Saudi Arabia is sending its crown prince and deputy crown prince, who is the country's defense minister, in King Salman's place. Aru Pandey, the White House.
Yemen's Houthi rebels say they've shot down a Moroccan F-16 warplane taking part in the Saudi-led air campaign targeting them ahead of a humanitarian ceasefire due to go into effect on Tuesday. The Houthi-run news channel says the plane was shot down by anti-aircraft guns in Sada province near the Saudi border. This is VOA News. The United Nations says 300,000 people in South Sudan have lost access to life-saving aid after fighting forced relief groups to withdraw from the town of Lier. The pullout follows a surge in clashes involving rebel groups and government forces in South Sudan's Unity State. The UN warned last week that the violence has forced up to 100,000 people to flee their homes. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is heading to Russia for talks Tuesday with Russian President Vladimir Putin and other top officials in his first visit since relations plummeted over sharp disagreements on Ukraine and Syria. The State Department says Mr. Putin, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, and Mr. Kerry will discuss a full range of bilateral and regional issues. Europe is awaiting the next steps British Prime Minister David Cameron will take following the electoral victory of his Eurosceptic Conservative Party. Lisa Bryant reports.
With Mr. Cameron's promises to hold a referendum by 2017 on Britain's membership to the European Union, concerns about the EU's future are back. The two top EU chiefs, Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker and EU President Donald Tusk, say they're willing to listen and negotiate with Britain. French President François Hollande says he's also willing to discuss Britain's place in the EU. But Mr. Hollande says that while it's legitimate to talk about British aspirations, there are rules in Europe, including the free circulation of people, which Mr. Cameron wants to limit, that members must stick by. Lisa Bryant, Paris.
South Africa's main opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, says it has chosen Mmusi Maimane as its leader, making him the first black person to head the traditionally white party. The party hopes the move will widen its appeal in a country deeply divided along racial lines. Lawyers for convicted Boston Marathon bomber Zakhar Tsarnaev have concluded their bid to persuade a jury to sentence him to life in prison rather than death. The last of 44 witnesses called by his defense attorneys over 8 days of testimony was a Roman Catholic nun, Helen Prejean, a noted death penalty opponent. Two 20th century masterpieces smashed world records at a New York auction Monday, dubbed by collectors as the sale of the century. Pablo Picasso's The Woman of Algiers, version O, sold for more than $170 million at Christie's auction house, the highest price ever paid for a single painting. This is Peter Heinlein, VOA News, Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 12th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Burundi's president rejects a request to delay June 26 election.
Even in Nigeria, where a significant portion of the north is in the grip of Boko Haram Nebula, elections were held. So compared to this country, what is happening in Burundi is nothing and cannot prevent the holding of elections.
Willy Nyamitwa is senior advisor, media and communication to Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza. The European Union says migrants will not be forcibly repatriated. We'll look at the plight of migrants' families in their countries of origin. And a panel of experts urges better preparation for global health crises.
I think everybody is clear that it would have been preferable to have called the public health emergency earlier, but there are many, many reasons about why those judgments were extremely difficult to make, and in particular, the great difficulty of getting hold of data.
Barbara Stockin is the former chief of Oxfam. The EU says the continued disappearance of rights activist Itai Zamara may affect Zimbabwe-EU relations. And we will talk with an international dating expert in Uganda. Those stories plus Marco Woman's Sports and our Listener of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza has rejected an appeal from the European Union and the United States to delay the June 26 presidential election. Willy Nyamitwe, senior advisor to President Nkurunziza on media and communication, said delaying the election is a technical matter that must be managed by the Electoral Commission. In addition, he said the election is a constitutional mandate and Burundi must be careful not to create an institutional vacuum. The European Union said Monday that delaying the electoral timetable would help calm the situation in the country, where there have been deadly protests since President Nkurunziza announced his intention to seek a third term. Nyamitwe said if Nigeria, which has been gripped by Boko Haram violence, was able to hold its election on March 28, then Burundi can also have its election.
What you have to know is that this is a technical issue that must be managed by the Electoral Commission, not by the government. And sometimes we have to be careful because there may be an institutional vacuum, and that is very dangerous for the country. So that is the reason why this matter is going to be analyzed by the Electoral Commission.
But from the viewpoint of the government, would the government appreciate or would they welcome a delay? And what would that mean for President Pierre Nkurunziza if the elections are delayed?
We have no problem with any delay as long as there's no institutional vacuum. Because for a date, suppose an election is scheduled for 26th, but it's done 28th. This is not a problem for the government. The major problem is when it comes to an institutional vacuum, because it's very dangerous, it's unconstitutional. So we have to stick on the law, to stick on the constitution.
The constitution is that the election should take place on June 26th.
On June 26th, we have the presidential election, and if it is delayed, it can go until 26th July. This is the last time for the presidential election. So, as you know, the Electoral Commission is a technical team that has to manage all these issues to see that the country is protected from institutional vacuum.
According to the European Union and the United States, the European Union is making this suggestion because they want to calm the situation in your country where there continues to be violence.
Yeah, but let me recall that even in Nigeria, for example, where a significant portion of the north is in the grip of Boko Haram Nebula, elections were held, even in Mali. So compared to this country, what is happening in Burundi is nothing and cannot prevent the holding of elections. Remember that in Nigeria, it's a big part of the north. But in Burundi, it's a very small area, a very small area. We can say less than 1% of the territory of Burundi where people are protesting. So we cannot postpone elections because of this.
In terms of the violence, there was violence again on Monday. Have you been successful in trying to put the protests down?
I cannot say that protests are down, but it decreased. It's not like before, like the beginning. But those protesters couldn't go into the city. they are still in their suburbs, which means that this is under hand and under control.
Now, there is a meeting scheduled for Wednesday of the East African Community. Is President Nkurunziza going to attend this meeting?
Yes, he is attending.
Willy Nyametwe is the senior advisor on media and communication to Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza. He was speaking with me from the capital, Bujumbura. A panel of independent experts has criticized the World Health Organization's response to the Ebola crisis, saying the agency was not prepared and did not coordinate its activities with other organizations. The panel was commissioned by the WHO Executive Board in January to come up with recommendations for better handling of global health emergencies. Lisa Schlein reports from the WHO headquarters in Geneva.
This is only a preliminary report. The six independent experts are expected to release the final report in July. But based on the current analysis, it is apparent that errors and misjudgments were made that prolonged and deepened the Ebola crisis in West Africa. The chair of the panel, former Oxfam chief Barbara Stocking, says the WHO waited too long before declaring the Ebola epidemic in West Africa an international public health emergency.
I think everybody is clear that it would have been preferable to have called the public health emergency earlier, but there are many, many reasons about why those judgments were extremely difficult to make, and in particular, the great difficulty of getting hold of data. So some very difficult circumstances to try to judge.
WHO Director General Margaret Chan declared Ebola a public health emergency in August 2014, 6 months after the virus was discovered in Guinea and 9 months after the first case occurred in December. By then, there were more than 1,700 confirmed and suspected cases of the disease and 932 deaths in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. Stocking says it is essential the international health regulations that aim to help nations prevent and respond to acute public health risks be strengthened. She says this means countries must raise their level of preparation so they can respond quickly to an emergency.
Part of that preparedness, though, is one bit that we note was particularly problematic in the Ebola crisis, and that is getting communities on board, getting communities understanding and their awareness of Ebola. And we really believe that that was not done well enough in the early days of Ebola.
For example, Stocking notes, the WHO did not coordinate well enough with local or international aid groups to help explain why burial rituals and other traditional practices were adding to the Ebola fatality rate and needed to be changed. She says the panel believes the WHO should collaborate more closely with organizations such as Doctors Without Borders and use their expertise to deal with public emergencies. She says the panel of experts also recommends a global health emergency task force be established and put on standby to respond to disease outbreaks. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The European Union's foreign policy chief said Monday that migrants and refugees intercepted trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea would not be sent back to their home countries against their will. VOA's Margaret Bashir has more from the United Nations.
EU High Representative for Foreign Affairs Federica Mogherini addressed the UN Security Council Monday for the second time in as many weeks. She said the complex crisis of African and Arab migrants seeking to make their way to Europe using smugglers, who often leave them to perish at sea, does not have one magic solution, but rather requires a comprehensive response.
It is not only a humanitarian emergency, but also a security crisis, since smuggling networks are linked to, and in some cases finance, terrorist activities, which contributes to instability in a region that is already unstable enough.
This year, more than 1,800 people fleeing poverty, conflict, and oppression have died trying to cross the Mediterranean into Europe. Many have paid their life savings and more to unscrupulous traffickers who take them on perilous journeys that often include Libya, which itself is in a state of conflict and chaos, where the traffickers often abandon them or send them out to sea aboard vessels that are unsafe and overcrowded. Mogherini was clear that rescued migrants would not be forcibly repatriated.
Let me explicitly assure you that no refugees or migrants intercepted at sea will be sent back against their will. Their rights under Geneva Conventions will be fully honored.
Mogherini said Libya is not the only gateway for smugglers into Europe, but that the majority of trafficked people are coming through that country.
As long as there will not be a unity government that will exercise its legitimate authority over the entire territory of the country and its land and sea borders, the situation is likely to continue this way.
She told reporters that the EU Commission will meet Wednesday to adopt its new agenda for migration, and it will likely include stepped-up search and rescue operations and expanded visas for migrants. At the UN Security Council, Britain and France have been drafting a resolution that diplomats say would seek to authorize action against suspected smugglers' vessels on the high seas, in Libya's territorial waters, and along its coast. Mogherini said the draft would be circulated to the full council on Monday. She said it would be similar in principle to council resolutions in place since 2008, authorizing maritime action against pirates operating off of Somalia. Those resolutions allow international counter-piracy action to be carried out within Somali territorial waters and on land in Somalia. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 12th. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. As European Union leaders meet this week to address the current migrant crisis, Senegalese Red Cross workers provide support to families of migrants in their home countries. Red Cross workers such as Nicolas Mende provide psychosocial support to family members of those who tried to make the journey. Mandy tells Ricky Stryak that the families left behind suffer both economically and emotionally.
This situation is not easy. We know that there are a lot of people who die in the sea. We have a project to help this family. The project is to relieve the emotional suffering of these families.
What kind of activities do you have to help relieve their suffering?
We do with the family psychosocial support group. We participate to the creation of association of missing migrant families in Charoy, in Ganjol. Ganjol, we have two localities, Njeden and Tirotbar. And we have association and we do activities with these families. We work with the women to help them to do literacy for women and professional training, women entrepreneurship, and for the children of the missing. We have during school building a huge group of Red Cross for the children. We do also summer camp for the children.
These people, you're saying they've disappeared. Have many of them still not been found then or located by their families?
Yeah. Yeah, for the disappeared person, we have with our with the ICRC, we do the search of these people.
Do you ever sometimes locate these people who have disappeared? I'm sure some of them have been lost at sea.
No, we haven't yet, but we continue to search. And if you have some information, we go to share it with the families.
What were some of the reasons that were given when these people left to try and get to Europe through certain land and sea routes?
The reason that they give us is they go to find a better situation, a financial situation, and to help their families. That is really the reason that they give us.
Are these families working at all within their communities to share information to combat this type of immigration?
Yes, the association of Charoy fight against the immigration.
Nicolas Mende is the head of Red Cross's psychosocial support programs for the families of disappeared migrants. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from St. Louis, Senegal. Yesterday, Monday, marked 2 months since the alleged abduction of Zimbabwe human rights activist Itaya Zamora. To mark the occasion, the European Union warned Monday that Zamora's continued disappearance could affect Zimbabwe-European Union relations. In a statement, the EU said President Robert Mugabe's government must take every step necessary to ascertain Zamora's whereabouts and safeguard his well-being. Political analyst Nkululeko Sibanda says he hopes the EU will be able to carry out its threat.
Well, I think that this is a very admirable stance by the European Union. However, the only problem is that it is a stance that is almost impossible for either the European Union to follow forward or to defend on the international stage, perhaps with any other competitors, international relations such as China and Russia. And we know very well that the EU is eager to get into Zimbabwe following the growth and other African countries following the growth of Chinese influence there. And I think that for that reason alone, the European Union is certainly taking a difficult stance and may not be able to carry it through.
Do you think the European Union is now regretting rolling back its sanctions on ZANU-PF?
In the big scheme of things, because international relations is not necessarily about aid and about human rights. International relations is about the interests of the relating countries. I therefore think that the issue, Zamara's issue, and the issue of the position that the EU has taken will always be subject to the economic and political interests, which I think will always go take precedence. Therefore, I do not think that the EU will is regretting this position. I think that they will from time to time make condemnations, just as President Obama recently said that, you know what, Colonel Gaddafi was a dictator. We could constantly bash at and lambast for human rights abuses, but he was not necessarily a terrorist. And I think that occasionally you find that the West does a good job of condemning human rights abuses without necessarily taking any substantive action. And I think that this is going to be the case in the long term.
Political analyst Nkululeko Sibanda was speaking from London with reporter Untungamile Nkomo of VOA Zimbabwe Service. If you are in Uganda, what's the least attractive quality for a potential first date? As a tourist in Myanmar, what's the worst way to meet a girl on the street? To answer these questions and others you may never have thought to ask, viewers Heather Murdoch talked to an international date and culture reporter.
Matthew Stein, a Canadian journalist in Uganda, publishes datingcultures.com. Here are some of the titles of his past video reports.
There was street flirting in Yangon, Rwanda's wet and wild tradition, gay all the way in Bergen, Norway, on stage at a Ugandan sex show, and of course, sex-bushed.
In the sex-bushed videos, Stein asks people on the street questions about local dating customs, offering small cash prizes, about $4, to winners.
Third question for $10,000. What would make somebody unacceptable for a first date in Uganda? A, if they're poor, B, if they're ugly, or C, if they're a smoker.
In Uganda, apparently smoking is the least attractive quality in a first date, according to a local survey. But some shopkeepers in the video object, saying poverty is a much bigger problem than smoking when it comes to dating. In this video from Myanmar, Stein tries to meet women on the street.
You drink beer or coffee? Can we meet sometime and have a drink together?
No, sorry.
No? But even later? Like... Yeah. Tonight or tomorrow, weekend?
Yeah, sorry. No.
Sorry, you're not free?
Yes.
You're so free. I'd like to meet you.
Thank you.
He is turned away by young women, explaining they don't go out at night because their culture demands obedience to their parents, who wouldn't approve. Stein says his material uses humor and a universally held interest in romance to draw people's attention to related issues they otherwise may not think about.
If I were to publish a story about Ugandan politics, that would only appeal to so many people. But if I use dating, which is a more universal subject, I think more people will watch, and in the process, they'll be exposed to other issues in that country that they wouldn't normally see in a two-minute news report.
For example, other articles on his website about Uganda talk about abuses towards gay and transgendered people and women's rights. Dating Cultures videos have been filmed in roughly a dozen countries on four continents. The project used to be called Erotic Routes, a name creators recently abandoned because of complaints that it could make people think of pornography rather than cultural exploration. Stein says talking about sex or romance publicly in many of the countries he works in is often considered taboo. In his opinion, it shouldn't be.
I think it's a very important thing to talk about in countries where people are not able to talk about sex and their sex life. There's a whole bunch of problems that manifest itself, from STDs to teenage pregnancies.
And while these are serious consequences, he and his team hope to chip away at these taboos with jokes. Articles, videos, and international guides in the works also seek to encourage cross-cultural dating, Stein says, and prepare daters for what they may encounter as they travel the globe. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa's Post. And here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with golf. Defending champions South Africa clinched their 17th successive victory at the All Africa Junior Golf Championships in Lusaka, Zambia on Sunday. Zimbabwe was second and Zambia third. They were followed by Kenya, Swaziland, Uganda, Tunisia, Namibia, Botswana, while Mauritius were placed 10th. Turning to athletics, Kenyan Stephen Sambu clocked a lifetime best of 27 minutes and 30 seconds to win the Great Manchester 10-kilometer run in Britain on Sunday. South African Stephen Mokoka was runner-up in a career best time of 27 minutes and 38 seconds. Mokoka also betters the South Africa 10-kilometer record from 27 minutes and 50 seconds held by Shadrack Hoff since 2002. Kenyan Bernard Lagat was third in 27 minutes and 48 seconds. The trio are the world's fastest runners in 10 kilometers this year. Meanwhile, Kenyan Betsy Saina won the women's race in 31 minutes and 49 seconds. Britain's Gemma Steele was 6 seconds behind, while Kenyan Edna Kiplagat was third in 31 minutes and 57 seconds. In football, despite hosts Kenya beating Botswana 4-1 in the return leg of the Africa Under-23 Championship qualifier in Nairobi on Saturday, Botswana progressed to the second round on the away goal rule after they drew 4-all on aggregate. In Djibouti, Rwanda held their hosts Somalia to a 1-all draw to progress on a 3-1 aggregate. Meanwhile, hosts Zambia beat Malawi 2-0 in a friendly played in Lusaka on Saturday. Today, Tuesday, Kazakhstan host Burkina Faso in Almaty. In rugby, South Africa edged hosts Scotland 12-10 in the plate final at the IRB 7 series in Glasgow, Scotland on Sunday, while Argentina beat Kenya 24-7 in the ball semi-final. At the end of the penultimate leg of this year's IRB 7 series, South Africa dropped to second place in the overall standings with 142 points. Kenya is 13th with 38 points, while Zimbabwe is 20th with 1 point. Finally, in cycling, 22-year-old James Reid led Matthew Bilkes, Rookie Crozier, Brendan Davis and Philip Byers in a 1-2-3-4-5 South African sweep at the Africa Mountain Bike Continental Championships in Musanze, Rwanda on Sunday. Mauritius is second and Rwanda third. The contest is a qualifier for the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Tuesday morning, May 12.
Good morning. This is William Kokula from Borga, Liberia. And there's a great news that Liberia has been declared Ebola-free by the World Health Organization, WHO. I'd like to commend our president, Her Excellency Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, for her leadership role played, our health workers, our international partners, and the resilience of the Liberian people. I hope and pray that our neighboring countries, Guinea and Sierra Leone, will join us shortly. Thank you and have a great day.
Thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The United Nations says 300,000 people in South Sudan have lost access to life-saving aid after fighting forced relief groups to withdraw from the town of Leer. That is it for this Tuesday, May 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, political satire from the African diaspora, poking fun at political and religious figures and symbols can make you laugh, but it can also stir up a great deal of controversy. Straight Talk Africa comes to you on Wednesday at 18:30 UTC. Join the discussion. That's next time on VOA Africa.